This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. In 1942, Tony Giannunzio was invited to a tryout with Chicago Cubs, but service in the U.S. Coast Guard during World War II superseded his baseball career. Giannunzio finally made it to the pitcher's mound at Wrigley Field 70-plus years later when he threw out the first ball before the Cubs played the Royals last year. Tony Giannunzio is also the author of the book The Last Romantic War, A Blind Date with History. Tony Giannunzio, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Let's talk a little bit about baseball before World War II. Where did you play? Were you primarily a pitcher? Did you play other positions?
I played several positions, but I loved pitching, and that was my specialty. However, I loved hitting, base running, throwing, just the atmosphere of baseball.
And where did you play?
In Iron Mountain, Michigan, as a young man, 18, 19 years of age. Our ball field was up in Pine Mountain, and we had cumulus clouds galore. The weather was baseball weather. We had baseball skies all summer long, and every Sunday was the day of the week I just waited for and dreamed about.
What do you mean by baseball skies? Just a little cloud so the background isn't too bad?
Smallish cumulus cloud so you could gauge where that baseball was. You had another dimension to target the baseball. I never heard the term during those years.
And why did you look forward so much to Sunday?
Sunday, in fact, I even dreamed the ball game, what I was going to do in it, how it was going to turn out. Various players, and I knew a lot of these players because I used to watch the games when I was 12, 13, 14, and I had idols out there. Hatze Soderberg playing shortstop, Webb Jacobson, a fellow by the name of Oketty, Wally Smiling, Jack Rahoy, the players were just tremendous. I just remembered their every move. And I had an older brother who would take me to the ball game. I was, 11, 12, 13. That's when I had my first ideas about baseball and began thinking about the Chicago Cubs.
So tell us what led up to you getting a tryout as a young man back in the 40s with the Chicago Cubs. Yeah.
Part of that is a mystery, frankly. It had to have been one of the board of directors on our baseball team. And he was the conductor of the Chippewa train that traveled from Iron Mountain to Chicago daily. And he loved baseball. And he must have been this catalyst. And I think my wife is the one who gave me the idea, because I never really found out how I got that tryout. But I did get a letter from the Cubs asking me to come to Janesville, Wisconsin. And I was excited about it. It was before our season began. That was the beginning.
Did you ever actually make it to Wisconsin?
Yes. Yes, I did get there for the tryout, and the tryout was, to me, sensational. I mean, it was scary to begin with. I hitchhiked with $5 in my pocket, and that was to go from Iron Mountain to Sun Prairie, something like 300 miles. And, of course, $5 wouldn't last too long, even then, I got there, and they simply seemed to have thought I was an infielder. At least immediately I was put at third base, and in infield practice, I still remember that hitter hitting a skipping smash at me at third base. It skipped off my glove, hit my knee, and I think in a few minutes later, I was removed from that position.
Were you okay? Were you injured?
Oh, yeah, I was okay. I didn't have any mark or anything. I was surprised I even got down there to stop that liner. I guess they were telling me, don't crowd third base. Big league ball players play about 10, 15 feet behind the bag,
That's why bunts are sometimes really successful, because it's a long way to run in.
That's right. I mean, I can't believe how well those third basemen, some of them make that underhand throw to first base on the run.
So did you ever get a chance to show them what you could do as a pitcher?
I certainly did. That's why I got the Askins all the way up to the Chicago Cubs. Earl Whitehill, who pitched for the Chicago White Sox and the Cleveland Indians, and I think he's in the Hall of Fame, left-handed pitcher. He was very friendly to me, and he even tried to show me how to throw a curve. You know, he thought the curveball was to be a wrist motion snap. That was not the way I threw a curve. But anyway, I was out there. I was the starting pitcher. They suspected that I could do something because I had this great-looking Iron Mountain Ranger uniform. It was a terrific uniform. And so I went out there, and Janesville Cubs of the Wisconsin State League, they were the opposition. And for the life of me, I don't remember anybody hitting the ball, maybe a few ground balls. I pitched for 3 innings. Whitehill insisted once, keep showing me that fastball, because my curveball was not, you know, timed perfectly. It was the first time I was on a very high mound, and I hadn't gotten my rhythm. And I had quite a, what do you call it, a sort of a hitch in my hips, leaning back, and I was coiled to throw every pitch I was going to throw. And when I see, very few pitchers are doing that today. They stand on the walls, on a mound, straight up, and throw dead ahead. And it seems to me that's a fairly, you know, very easy way to hit. But anyway, I impressed them. As I said earlier, nobody hit anything. I couldn't remember. I wish I had the scorebook. But at the end of the third inning, a downpour came, and it really flooded things out for about 15 minutes, and they called the game. I even had a chance to bat, and I hit a liner to Frank Christie, the first baseman. And I remember that ball. It was a liner. Hit his glove about chest high, skipped straight up in the air about 15 feet, and came right back down. And for a while, I thought they were going to get back to me as a hitter instead of a pitcher. But right on the mound, and just a bit later, we had to circle the field. Just run it, and I was the fifth guy picked. I knew I was going to be picked. I knew I had to be. No one was hitting me. It was no problem. And that's been the story of my younger pitching career.
So was there an opportunity, or did you sense an opportunity to—
I was told immediately there by Earl Whitehill. He said, you're going up to the Cubs. You're going to have 30 days. You'll have expenses. We don't know what they're going to do with you, but we know they're going to do something with you. And that was fine with me. They said, you go on home. The Cubs will be in touch with you immediately. They were in touch with me about 3 days later. I got a letter from the Cubs. But only after Franklin Roosevelt lowered the draft age to 19, and I was 19 years old. I heard that, and I didn't realize that was going to affect my chances. I got a letter from the Cubs about 3-4 days later saying, due to the lowering of the— I still remember the words. I should have kept the letter. I remember the words. They would cut my heart in half, I think. They said, due to the lowering of the draft age to 19, take care of yourself and see us after the war. Oh, those were the toughest one-liners I've ever experienced. And I didn't realize then, the Cubs should have said, well, come on in anyway, and we'll wait till you're drafted or whatever. Because I didn't go into the service, I volunteered, not till October 27th of that year.
And this was when that we're talking about, that you got the letter from?
1942.
And you got the letter from the Cubs when? What month?
May.
May, okay.
And that's when the tryout was, the first week of May.
And then you actually volunteered.
Yeah.
Right? You weren't drafted.
I volunteered about 3 weeks later, yeah.
For the Coast Guard.
Yes. I'll say that just a bit later than that, because we played a tournament in Milwaukee. I was playing second base. And I was hitchhiking again to Lake Forest College, because I was all set to go to college at Lake Forest College. A friend of mine, who we had played ball together in the senior league in Iron Mountain, he says, come on down here to Lake Forest College. I'll get you a job, which he did. I worked there for 2-3 days, incidentally. And that's when I had to go on back home, because the draft board said, you're going to come in. But I had already enlisted. And so that was the end of my college career at this fine liberal arts school, Lake Forest, Illinois. And there I was, just ready to go, in great shape.
So what did you do in the Coast Guard?
Well, a crazy thing happened. Karma all over the place. Some very polite coxswain's mate had the audacity to jiggle the watch, the clock, and giving the impression that I had not been there or either slept on watch. This was at South Shore in Chicago. And, of course, that was nonsense. And I was called in, and the skipper of the Coast Guard station there grilled me for about, oh, God, a half an hour. I certainly didn't do that. Finally, this fellow came into the room and said, look, I'm the one who slept on watch. And, you know, I didn't know enough. I was still innocent enough. I should have punched him right then. But I didn't even think of it, you see? And so the skipper there said, all right, I was pretty tough on you and so forth and all that. But he says, you, if you want, you can go to any school you want. Just name it right now. God, I was taken off guards. He says, you've got to do it, though, right away. And then he said, 5 minutes. I'll give you 5 minutes to name your school. Where you want to go? What do you want to do in the service? Well, what did I want to do in service? God, I was, about 20 years old and about 5 months into that 20th year. I didn't know. I wasn't going to be an electrician's mate. I wanted to go to college. How would I know? You know, did I want to be a signalman? No. So I said, I might as well, I'll be a gunner's mate or gun captain. He said, okay, you're going to Great Lakes, just like that. He says, get ready, pack your sea bag, you're leaving tomorrow morning.
Okay, for someone who's not familiar, what does a gunner's mate or gunner's captain do?
I didn't have too much understanding of it. I'd seen some movies of, gunfire off ships and all of that. And that's what I wanted to do, really. If I was going to do anything in the service, I wanted to be on a ship, and I wanted to be a gunner's mate, and I didn't think I'd ever be a gun captain. But I was all of that, plus having had one very fabulous and daring and dangerous experience.
But you're the guys that are running the guns that are on the boat then?
I was a gun captain.
Okay.
And I had 320s, and for a while, I had a quad 40 and an aircraft gun. The 20s were all anti-aircraft. They could hit surface things, too, as far as that goes. And that's what I did. Plus, I was in charge of the depth charges on the fantail and K-guns on the fantail.
And, how many years were you in the Coast Guard?
Too long.
The entire war?
The rest of it, and plus another 6 months or so. We had about 60,000 miles at sea in the Pacific, mainly. That's a couple of times around the world, plus I think I was in at least 25 ports, almost none of them, well, I shouldn't say that. Let's just say a goodly share of them, there was no city involved. It was just a harbor or a dock or a bay, like in Bora Bora, which was a great entrance into the Pacific, now way down in the southwest Pacific, on the way to New Guinea.
So if you look back on that service, are there a couple memories that jump out in terms of, I'm sure there's a lot of them, but maybe one or two of them that are perhaps the most worthy of sharing?
Most worthy. Well, of course, the kamikaze was the craziest one because it was so daring and exciting and lasting in my mind because, well, should I mention
is this a kamikaze that was coming in trying to hit your ship?
That's right. Wow. No, not trying to hit us, using us as a screen. We were nine ships in a convoy. Four of us were frigates, five empty liberties going to Eniwetok and Ulithi, where the Fifth Fleet was quartered. There were about 2,000 ships there getting ready for Okinawa. And it was, to me, memorable because I could have shot all three of them down in a fraction. I was strapped in. I had the magazine in the gun. I called for some wandering sailor to come on in with the next magazine if I needed it. And I asked for permission to fire. No GQs. This is a lengthy, wonderful story. And it was a lengthy, almost sometimes a nightmare to me because I wanted to shoot those planes out. It was my duty to do it. But the Yalta agreement with Russia, part of it was we were to loan four frigates to the Russians because they had nothing on sea in northern Japan. They had nothing to, so we had to go there and train them up in the Kobe near Kodiak, Alaska, at the end of the Aleutian chain, and just give the ships up just for loan till the war ended. War ended about 3 months later. But meanwhile, I think that was the key thing. There were about five other reasons why I was denied permission to fire twice. These were a Betty bomber, a Tony Army fighter, and a reconnaissance plane. Right under my nose, 10 yards away from me, I could see the poker face of the Betty bomber pilot. I didn't know what it was all about for years and years, decades, until I saw something on the History Channel telling me that was a tryout mission to see if these kamikaze pilots could stick to their guns and carry out the mission. I didn't know that. If I had known that, I might have I hit the trigger and it would have been nothing because those Japanese planes were made of canvas. Just two shots would stop the plane if you hit them. But yet I felt a little bit of, there's no emotion to tell it, but it's fairly close to a kind of a sadness that I had so desired to nail them because they had the audacity to come that close. I mean, I wanted to stay alive. I was the only guy really on the after end of the ship. We were in tough weather, harsh weather. There was nobody topside except the lookouts and the OD and his helper, his seaman there. We were worn out from the late time we had there, about 2 weeks in port, saying hello to the Japanese washing machine Charlies that kept visiting us at midnight and other planes for 2 weeks, and we were worn out. And I guess not too happy about having to be interrupted. This was in the channel leading in, and there were submarine nets there, and I guess I never could figure this out until I realized later that the Yalta Agreement was part of our, trade-off.
So what did you do after the war?
Well, of course, I was headed to college. I couldn't wait to go. And when I learned about the GI Bill, we had left Hawaii, and President Truman, somehow or other, I don't know why he did, because Roosevelt was still living when we were coming back in late March 1945. I learned about that bill, and I thought it's going to be easy going for me now. And I knew where I was headed, Western Michigan University. And I happened to hold the first master's degree from Western as a university, by the way. It was an accident, which I don't want to talk about.
That sounds like a good story, though.
But going to college was my dream. I knew I was raw, but I knew I was capable of cultivating a mind and becoming, growing. And that's what life is, growing and becoming. It's not static.
And this led to education, correct?
It did, yes, and culture. And I've never regretted it, believe me.
And you taught?
Yes, I taught at, my first teaching job. There's a little story there. I don't know if I should tell it. But can you imagine?
Who are you getting in trouble at this point?
No, there's no trouble.
Okay.
But sorry. A little bit of nice trouble. And I was thankful, of course, for my World War II experience, because the last segment of my jaunt over to Sundance, Wyoming, first one was a train to Pierre, South Dakota, Dakota from Kalamazoo, and the next was a bus trip to Spearfish, South Dakota, but I still had to negotiate about 50 more miles from Spearfish, South Dakota, to Sundance, Wyoming, this glamorous name of Sundance, named after an Indian dance, I guess, held beneath the bluff, the famous bluff of Sundance. But how to get there was a problem. There was no transportation, and I wasn't going to hitchhike there. I had two suitcases. So somebody told me near the bus station where, unfortunately, there was a whole, what's the word for a group of Indians? A tribe almost, yeah. Most of them drunk, hanging around the bus station. And that was really good local color, believe me. Someone told me that down the street or so, the fellow had an airplane, and they knew he often would pilot people here and there. So they took me to his place, and I said, I want to go to Sundance, Wyoming. He says, yeah. And I said, how much is it going to cost me? Can you do it? It was Sunday afternoon. He says, sure, $10, okay? Here I am, a college grad. Ready to go to get a job there. And that's another story, which, of course, I can't tell now. I have 100 stories. So he had a two-seater plane, and I crammed into the behind the pilot. And all was well. There was no airport, even in Spearfish. But there was some level ground somewhere where he took off. And so we got over to Sundance, saw this sheer cliff, this marvelous-looking cliff that overlooks the valley of Sundance and the village. And I just happened to notice, I said, does Sundance have a landing field? He said, no. Oh. He said, don't worry, I'll find a place to land.
Oh, boy.
I guess he must have done it before, you know. He says, if it comes to, the impossible, I'll land on the highway. I mean, there's a lot of room on the highway. Don't worry about it. But we did land on an incline of about 2 or 3 degrees. And after that, I had to find some way to get into town 2 miles away. So I hitchhiked. And here I am reporting for duty, as it were. I found the superintendent's house. I said, I'm here. He said, okay. All you have to do now is go over to Howard Johnson's. They've got a very nice place, little units there. And incidentally, I was married. My wife was back in Kalamazoo. That's the end of that, and I'm gesturing way too much here. You can imagine what I'm doing.
Let's fast forward to this call that you get and the opportunity to go and throw out the first ball at Wrigley Field. How does that happen?
One of the greatest moments of my life. Carolyn was there, too, and she knew this before I knew it. But they didn't trust her with the emotional aspect of it, so they, when all of this was told to her, this was my fourth interview with Dan Deal. And
this is for the video Salute to Honor.
This is for this, that's right, for this documentary.
Features
Salute
you.
To Honor, yes.
Features you and two other gentlemen from West Michigan who served
World
War II.
Incidentally, it world premiered last November 3rd. At any rate, in the last section of our fourth interview, he stopped and said, "Tony, I'm going to have to ask you a question." And of course, he connected up or made it live. He said, "Tony, the Cubs are inviting you to throw the ceremonial first pitch at Wrigley Field either May 3rd or the 31st. I said, "What?" And I was stunned. I don't know, you must have seen me stunned. And I had to turn away, you know, for a moment. And I came back. I said, "What did you say?" He repeated it. "The Cubs would like to have you throw that first pitch." I said, "Yes." My eyes, I know, were semi-liquefied. And he said, "Good." He said, "But which date do you want to do it?" And I thought May 31st was, you know, Memorial Day. And I wasn't quite in shape yet. And this, this was about a week before May 3rd.
You wanted some more time to get out and throw the ball a little
because
bit.
Because we were having a harsh spring. And you know all about it. Rain, cold, and everything. And I had to dig up somebody to catch, you know. I finally found somebody to catch. Now, there's a lot of story in that, in my getting in shape. And I wasn't in shape, believe me. I wasn't able yet to dip back, you know, lean back and get a full rhythm.
Okay, let's make sure now that our listeners understand, you are how old at the time this call came?
Let's see. I would have been 93 in about 2 or 3 months.
Okay. Most of us at 93 are not thinking about our technique and our mechanics for pitching at that point.
Yeah, exactly. I know. Just get out there and
throw the
lob
ball.
It, you know? But if you'll notice in one of the pictures, Justin Grimm took a crouching position behind home plate. He did that because I had thrown about 8 warm-up pitches to him about maybe 5 or 10 minutes before that, all of them thrown to his chest, something like around 45 feet away, not the full distance of 60, you know. But he respected me considerably. And when I did throw that pitch, I just loved that moment. It was just so out of this world, surreal, and maybe beyond that, because it was all of my life. I was living 2 dimensions there.
You were more than 45 feet away, though, weren't you? When you threw that pitch, you looked to me like you're right on the mound.
I was on the mound.
Yeah.
That's right. But I did not bring my left leg up or, you know, rear back like I did when I pitched, and I had a 3/4 arm curveball, 3/4. It was called a crossfire. Almost nobody threw a curve like that.
And if you had done that, you think the ball comes in across the plate?
And the reason for that was I was wearing my bifocals and it threw off my vision. My throw was a line drive. The ball was released late. And so I lost that perfect, you know, trajectory, see? But it went in and it skipped in like that. It took 2 skips and Grimm, who was a very good relief pitcher, by the way, he won some good ball games for the Cubs past year, and he volunteered to catch me. And I'm not done with that guy yet. Okay. He's going to catch that ball over the plate, I hope, maybe this coming summer. I'm getting in shape now, really.
Have you been in contact with the Cubs about coming back?
I have not been in contact at all. I'm not reluctant to push my, you know, desire, but I think, well, Dan knows I desire it, and he's probably going to get in touch. And I have things to do with Arrieta. I know what his problem is, and right now it's worth at least $500,000. They don't have a coach who knows what he did wrong against the New York Mets. He was so hittable in that eighth inning. Pathetic. All because he worried about holding that guy on first base. Really, it was pathetic.
So if you do go back and you
and
get another
I will
shot,
if they ask.
You're going to go from the mound again?
Well, of course. I'm going to ask for five pitches.
Five pitches.
That's right, because that's what a guy gets, you know, before he starts the inning. Why shouldn't I get it? I mean, if I'm going to pretend to be a pitcher, and who knows, maybe I can't pitch it. My energy and strength are still excellent. I could pitch an inning with no problem, three innings. But, you know, I have to trust my left knee yet. On a stride like that coming across, there's a lot of action happening. It's a whip. You know, it's like a cocking the whole body. I've seen pitchers do that.
Well, if you get another shot, let's have you back in here and we can talk about that experience another
time. I would
time.
Be glad to return and say, I told you so. A whole lifetime of I told you so.
Sounds
but I
good.
Knew I could do it because, you remember, I faced Glenn McQuillan of the St. Louis Browns without knowing it. He was their cleanup hitter back in 1942-43. I faced him, and I should be immodest here and just say I shackled him but good without knowing I was pitching to a big leaguer. I was told by an officer minutes, moments later, do you know who you were thrown to? Glenn McQuillan. St. Louis Browns. And my heart just thumped and thumped, and I walked away, and it was just one of the best moments of my life. I knew I could pitch in the big leagues.
Tony, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. I enjoyed it.
Tony Giannunzio is one of the subjects of the video Salute to Honor. He is also the author of The Last Romantic War, A Blind Date with History. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.